Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Triangulation, episode 245, recorded Monday, April 11th, 2016. James Gosling. Triangulation is brought to you by PillPack, a full-service online pharmacy that combines modern technology, convenient packaging, and personalized service to make your life easier. Visit PillPack.com/TWiT to save $20 on vitamins and OTCs when you transfer your prescriptions. And by Texture, the mobile app that lets you access the world's most popular magazines anytime, anywhere using your phone or tablet. For your free trial, visit texture.com/triangulation. It's time for Triangulation, the show where we get together with some of the most interesting people in technology. We get to spend an hour with them talking about anything they want to talk about, really. For those of you tuning in wanting to see the second half of our incredible interview last week with Bill Atkinson, we haven't decided yet. I think that's going to come up in a couple. When is are we going to air that, Karsten, next week? Or we don't know yet. But we have. He did 3 hours with us, so we divided it into two, and much more with Bill Atkinson. Really great stuff. And he's also going to come back because he said, "Well, would you mind? Because I really want to promote this photo card, which he calls his greatest invention ever. I really want to show people how to use it." And I said, come back, anything you want to do, Bill is okay with me. But I am thrilled this week to introduce our guest, who is also legendary, a brilliant computer scientist who has found the means to continue programming his entire life. And I guess if you're one of the creators of Java, you earned that. James Gosling is here with us today, and it's really a pleasure to meet you, sir. Thank you for joining us today.
Well, I'm happy to be here.
I'm not going to begin with Java. I want to go back even farther. I like to ask people. First of all, I just read on Hacker News a very sad piece by somebody who said, "I wish I hadn't stayed a programmer. Here I am at the age of 59, and I missed all the opportunities that I would have gotten had I gone into management." You seem to be pretty gainfully employed, and are you happy continuing to write code?
I am completely thrilled writing code. All of my worst hours are, you know, when I'm in meetings talking to people, when I'm like not coding. I don't know. I just get no joy from managing. I'm awful at it. My experiments in management have been I just don't want to do it.
I don't blame you. But you, of course, found a niche that you really enjoy too. Let's go back to the beginning. When did you discover computing? We're the same age. When you and I were in college, it was big computers, usually in the special room in the basement.
Yeah. And you know, I grew up in, you know, kind of backwoods Canada.
Calgary.
My parents, Calgary. Yeah. Which at the time was not terribly big. It had a university, which at the time was relatively small. It did have a data center, and we lived about 3 miles from it. And one day when I was like, I just like turned 14, my dad, a friend of my dad, worked at the university, and we wandered over for a tour, and we just kind of like wandered through the buildings, and we walked through the data center, and I just thought it was the coolest looking thing ever. It didn't make any sense to me, but it was really, really cool. But, you know, I was, you know, this like somewhat tall 14-year-old, and I started just going over there and, you know, reading books, and, you know, it didn't take very long to figure out how to dumpster dive to get, you know, login IDs to the IBM 360s. And
wow.
Of course, the really interesting machines were the sort of small PDP-8s.
Because they were closer to something you could, you know, you could own instead of timeshare.
Well, it wasn't so much about owning. They just had stuff connected to them.
Ah. Like vector displays and...
Displays and keyboards and key punches and tape drives and stuff that you could like touch and whatever. And you know, the one of the things about universities is that that if you just kind of bluster your way through, they just kind of figure you're supposed to be there because it's filled with students who are always kind of like strangers, right? The staff always expect unusual people to be wandering through, and if you kind of act like you're supposed to be there, they just sort of assume you are. You know, a bunch of the doors to like where all the PDP-8s were, they had these rather primitive keypad entry systems. And, you know, if you just like stand around nonchalantly, it's really easy to figure out what the magic key code is.
I love it.
So I did a lot of that, and I got to be friends with a number of the folks there, and I pretty much taught myself to program by breaking in and spending endless hours in the computer center's library, and got to know a bunch of the folks there, and you know, they you know, anybody who asked who I was and what I was doing, I was always completely honest about what I was doing. And then...
They probably were thrilled that you were interested, right?
Yeah. Well...
A smart
kid,
right? And
then some folks from the physics department hired me. You know, because I sort of knew what to do, and I was really cheap. And, you know, when you're a research project, you know, that's an important thing. You know, so I spent most of my high school years with this, strange job writing, ground station software for the ISIS II satellite.
No kidding. How interesting.
Yeah, it was kind
wow.
of, right. I skipped a lot of school, and my teachers were strangely happy with it.
No kidding. I'm just writing some satellite software and no big deal.
Well, they kind of figured out what I was doing, and they apparently did a little bit of cross checking, and since just about everybody else, you know, who was doing this in the, you know, we're talking, you know, the late 60s, early 70s, and you know, it was a pretty sketchy time, and you know, everybody else who was you know, ducking out of class was, you know, they were high on something.
Yeah, they were going out to smoke in the back, and you were going to write code. Would you write that code for the ISIS on a PDP-8?
Yeah, well, it was the ground station side.
Oh, okay, and that was a PDP-8.
Yeah, well, it was, some of it was on IBM, you know, 360 series. Some of it was on a PDP-8, and some of it was on a CDC 6400. All the heavy duty numerical stuff was on the CDC machines, but the stuff that took the analog telemetry signals and turned them into something that the CDC could read, and actually a lot of the error analysis and correction and was all done on the PDP-8, and even all of the displays. We did a lot of interesting work. Putting images up on screens, and of course back in those years, putting images on screens was quite a trick.
It's so interesting that so many of the coders, at least of our generation, but I think even later, that's the kind of the seminal age, 14. And if you were lucky enough to be exposed to a computer, you could you know, call your own. A certain number of people just became enthralled with it, and the mind at that point, I guess, is ready to take it on. Were you writing in the assembler for the PDP-8?
Well, certainly for the PDP-8, it was all assembler.
An octal.
Yeah, pretty. Well, no, there was an assembler language compiler.
Oh, good. For it, but you weren't doing
it. Was It was pretty darn primitive. I mean, this is a machine that had 4K memory banks, and you could add two or three additional memory banks for it. But, you know, on this box, all the code had to fit in 4K. And then we had a second memory bank that we could tie into the display. You know, so when everything has to fit in something in a space that small, you know, coding is a different exercise. I mean, it's almost comical the way people burn through RAM these days for code.
Oh, I know. I actually have on order a PDP-8 front face with the switches, but in behind it, it's a Raspberry Pi, a $35 Raspberry Pi emulating the PDP-8.
So which PDP-8? Because their front faces are somewhat different.
It's an 8i.
Oh, an 8i with the flat toggle switches.
Yeah,
the ones that rock.
Yeah, the rocker switches. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. That is the one to get. The 8er ones, the 8e and the 8l that have the paddle switches. Those suck.
My friend Steve Gibson, who does one of our shows, has four of these, and he said he kind of fantasizes that when he retires and he doesn't have to write Windows code anymore, he wants to write a PDP-8 operating system.
Well, I have written an awful lot of PDP-8 code.
You want to help him?
And PDP-8. Bootloaders.
That's what he cut his teeth on, like you.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about the switches on the 8i, the sort of rounded, flattish toggle switches, was you could take your fingers and swipe left and right and do like a series of buttons really quickly. So if you want to like clear the register to zero, you just have to like stick your finger on one side and swipe to the other.
Oh, wow.
And it was the ones that have the little toggle flip blade switches. Yeah. Those were a pain in the ass. And if you were trying to like toggle in a bootloader, you really, really cared about the shape of the switches.
No kidding. That's a lot of flipping.
Yeah.
Holy cow.
I'm so happy I'm not doing that anymore.
Yeah. So you weren't using a terminal. You were actually, you had to, well, for the bootloader, you couldn't, right? You had to,
right,
that was
right.
The first code. So you had to do that with the toggle switch. How many switch flips was that?
It was actually not a lot. There was effectively, you know, this like competition on, you know, how small bootloaders could be. And you could actually do a pretty credible one. It was dependent a lot on what you were booting from,
right?
You know, so typically you'd have a bootloader that read the second level bootloader off of paper tape reader. You know, so that bootloader would be sort of a dozen instructions.
Oh, that's not.
And then the
tape ticks.
Then off the paper tape reader, you'd read another one that would be about 128 words.
Right.
Because 128 words, you just never get it right. But you know, several of us had gotten to where the lowest level boot sequence that you had to toggle in by hand. You know, we just had to, like, completely memorized. You know, it's, you know, in that part of your brain that resides in your knuckles.
Do you think you could still do it if we brought you a PDP-8i?
Not a chance. Not a chance.
Come back to you.
Not a chance. Although I not very long ago I was talking with a friend and we were I think, you know, I've certainly got the instruction set completely memorized.
Steve loves the instruction set. One of the reasons he likes having a PDP-8, he says it's a very orthogonal, nice, simple instruction set, very clean.
Well, it's really simple. It has, but that simplicity comes at a cost. There are things about it, because in sort of later years, I wrote a fair number of code generators for it. And, you know, the interactions between the instruction set and the memory model were unbelievably bogus. And the way that, I mean, addressing on that thing was just so cheesy.
Couldn't be worse than x86, but maybe it could.
I oddly enough, it was actually worse than the original x86.
Wow.
You know, the sort of modern processors that just have, you know, a 64-bit integer, that makes life so
nice. Clean. Yeah. No segmenting. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you apparently fell for this stuff because you got a master's and a PhD at CMU. Mm-hmm. I presume, was it in computer science?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
And like any good programmer, you wrote your own version of Emacs.
Yeah, that was I did the very first one that showed up on Unix, and
no kidding.
So through I got to know Emacs on Multics.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if you remember Multics, sure. But a guy named Bernie Greenberg had written a version of Emacs in Lisp. And I got to use that one for a project that I did. I wrote a Pascal compiler for Honeywell. They hired me for a little while to write this Pascal compiler.
Was it a P-code compiler?
No.
It was native.
No, it was a straight from source code to Multics machine code.
Oh, interesting. I was going to make a big thing over to Java, but no, I won't do that.
The Multics machine was a glory to behold. I'm still very wistful about, you know, the way that Honeywell basically destroyed it. But what can I say? Mm.
So your Emacs was not in Lisp, though. It was in C, I think. Yes.
In C, yeah. So, I mean, the original one was, as the name Emacs suggests, it was a set of macros for a text editor called Tico.
Oh, yeah, that's right, yeah.
Yeah, Tico, I got to use Tico a lot at several phases of my life, and Tico and Line Noise are pretty much the same thing.
So, in a way, that's a claim to fame, because the original GNU Emacs was your Emacs, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, it went through kind of a twisted path, but it sort of started there.
Yeah. So how did you get to Sun?
When I was in grad school, because I was kind of the Unix guy, and I when I graduated, for some reason that I really doesn't make any sense to me anymore, I joined IBM to work on a project that was fairly interesting, and IBM wanted to build these machines that were sort of workstations, and you know, a bunch of the folks at Yorktown Heights Research Labs had this grand vision. I thought, oh, this would be really cool. And at about that time, because I had gotten to know, like, Bill and Andy, because Andy had actually been at CMU for a while.
Mm.
And I you know, as a grad student, one of my tasks at one point was to help fabricate some boards that Andy had designed. So I got to know Andy's design style, which was kind of adventurous. Well, he always wanted to put, like, more stuff on a board than you actually could. So, you would have to, like, file the ends off of chips to get them to fit. Or you'd have to do this, like, double stack thing where you put one chip on top of another chip and you splay the legs out in order to stuff it to the board. Always really pretty entertaining. But when Andy got together with Scott and Vinod to found Sun, I actually, by pure coincidence, was having lunch with Andy on the day that he signed the papers, and he was like twisting my arm to join Sun and you know, trying to get me to join on and help them out. And I'm like, but you're using like the Motorola 68000 chip and that thing has got and you know, this IBM group has got a really cool chip that they're using for their main processor. You know, you're just going to die. And
was it power? Was it the power PA Risk, PowerPC at that point? Or
it was the predecessor of that. It was a thing called the ROMP.
The ROMP.
And what I really hadn't understood was IBM's incredible capacity for shooting itself in the foot. Mm-hmm. And actually, if IBM merely shot itself in the foot, that would be fine. that might be survivable. But, so like a year and a half later, after Bill Joy kept like dragging me, I eventually joined Sun and moved out to the Bay Area and have been here ever since.
Quite legendary, of course. And Sun stood for the, was it Stanford University Network, right? Because they were all Stanford.
Well, it started out as Andy's, I think, master's thesis project.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was done, the original board was done at Stanford by Andy. So it really was the Stanford University Network.
Oh, interesting. I'm sure they reaped some reward for that over time.
Well, sure. So Stanford did quite well, right? When this board and the stuff that Andy had built worked out well. Some VCs got Scott and Vinod to come together with Andy to try to turn that into a company, and so they had some arrangement with Stanford to get the IP rights. And I know that, Stanford, did pretty well by them.
I'm sure, as they did by Google and others. It's, hey, if you, if you incubate great companies like that, more power to you. Bill Joy, on the other, he was from Cal, right? He had done BSD at Cal.
He was from Berkeley.
Yeah. So he was a Unix guy.
Yeah.
And I gather that the strength of Sun was that you were able to make these 68,000 base computers running Unix and high quality graphics.
Worked really well. And I mean, the 68,000 in the very first days of Sun, they were a real problem. But then once the 68010 came out, things got a whole lot better. And then the 68020 was just a dream machine. We did a lot with the 68020.
Mm. And a nice flat memory model, as I remember.
Yeah. Yeah. The 68010 was challenging. It didn't really have an MMU, or the 68000 didn't really have an MMU. The 68010 came in with a kind of okay MMU, and then the 20 came in. It was just delightful. A real multiplier.
Wow.
Who knew?
Who knew? We're going to take a break. When we come back, I want to talk about the birth of Java. And boy, I remember that very well. It was first Oak. Bill Joy came to you, I think, right? And said, let's do this thing. But I want to find out the story from the man, the father of Java. James Gosling is our guest. It's great to have him. And then later, we're going to talk about programming robots for undersea exploration. That's kind of cool. Submarines. But first, I want to talk a little bit about PillPack. This is a online pharmacy that has solved so many problems. This is very common, in the internet era. Now we're seeing companies move into spaces where there's an inefficiency. And in this case, the drugstore. We're in an old drugstore, The pharmacy was right over there. I remember it. I used to get the Beanie Babies over there. Now we go to PillPack.com. PillPack.com has pharmacists on duty 24/7, so you can call them anytime. And the PillPack is really the thing. So you get your medications or your vitamins in this great PillPack. Now, they also will ship ointments and inhalers, whatever. It can't go in here, but your pills do. And look at this. So it's got your name and your date on it. It has an image of every pill that's in the pill pack. That's important because they're using sophisticated image recognition to make sure that the pill packs are properly packed. And then a pharmacist goes over it by hand to make sure, double checked. You also have each pill is and the prescription that goes with it and the dosing directions. And then when it comes time to take a pill, look at that. It has the day, the date, the time, exactly what's in here. These are easy open. You just tear them open. And there's your pills, just like that. And the nice thing is you never have to worry. Did I take my my pills this morning? You know, because you've torn it off. This is really great for travel. And by the way, parents, for your kids who are about to go to summer camp in a couple of months, summer camps love these. The nurse will thank you. You should do it for that alone. She'll say, oh, thank you. I know exactly when to give your child his medication or her medication, what the medications are. It's all in there. You just tear it off. And by the way, no additional cost. Your insurance, in most cases, will cover this. There's no additional fee. It's just your deductible. The shipping is free. It's easy to switch to. You can go to their secure sites. Very easy to use. They'll take care of everything for you. It is compatible with most major insurance plans, including most forms of Medicare Part D. Yeah, this is really great. As you get older, I can vouch for the fact that it's easy to forget. I can't remember. Did I take my vitamins this morning? Your pill pack. No more pill box to load up Monday through Sunday. You got your pill pack. And by the way, if you want to talk to a pharmacist, they're there 24/7, and you can talk to them in the privacy of your own home. No more embarrassing conversations at the counter next to the Beanie Babies. When you need refills, they proactively contact your doctor to manage those, so you never run out. I love PillPack. By the way, if you refer someone to PillPack and they sign up, PillPack donates $100 to RxArt. That's a nonprofit whose mission is to help children heal through the extraordinary power of visual art. And they have a medication reminder app for the iPhone and the Apple Watch, too. PillPack.com/twit. Sign up now. When you transfer your prescriptions over, you get a credit for $20 worth of vitamins and over-the-counter medications. PillPack.com/twit. It is a better, simpler pharmacy, and I think you're going to really love it. So thrilled to have our guest here, James Gosling, Canadian. We point that out. We have many Canadian viewers, Calgary-born and bred, but he's in the South Bay now because he was lured there by Andy Bechtolsheim and Bill Joy and Scott McNeely and Vinod Khosla, who said, come to work for Sun. And you did very early on. It was in the first couple of years of Sun. What were your first projects software? They must have been, right?
Yeah. I sort of was hired to, like, figure out what I should do. And
I love that. That's respect. We'll let you decide.
They had a few software projects that were sort of scary, shimmery things, and I had to, like, figure out which one to, like, dive into. And there was some really low level OS stuff in the original Sun OS. And since, you know, when I was at Carnegie, I had done things like porting Unix to a multiprocessor. I had done that a few years before I graduated to a 16-way CPU, or 16 CPU machine.
Wow.
And so I'd spent a lot of time in the land of, you know, Unix device drivers. And so there were some projects that Bill wanted me to look at. And then there was some stuff in sort of graphics and user interface world, and there was more hair on fire in the graphics and user interface stuff. So
I bet there was.
I ended up spending, you know, pretty much all my time early on doing graphics and UI stuff, which tended to, in the early days in particular, was a lot of time writing low level device drivers to do, you know, all this crazy graphics rendering.
What do you like problems like that? What kind of problems do you like to solve?
Kind of anything.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not exactly a, you know, pigeonholed kind of person. I'm a happy sort of anywhere. I guess I'm a little happier down in the plumbing than I am up in the sort of, you know, glossy layout stuff, but I'm kind of a happy all over the place.
How did the idea for Java come about?
So Java was sort of a funny thing where a small group of us folks at Sun, we kind of had this sort of group epiphany that kind of the computer industry and Sun were sort of missing out on this transition that was happening in the world, namely that all the piece parts that we were used to seeing inside computers were showing up outside of computers. So they were showing up in, you know, elevators and TV sets and VCRs, and you know, these things were all becoming digital, and they were getting programmed. And you know, we had this deep view that this was going to be important. We're talking 1990 here, and you know, people in that world were largely unaware. Well, not exactly unaware. I mean, it was like dominated by electrical engineers who thought in terms of, you know, wires and chips and stuff, and not really in terms of software. And so whenever they built something that involved software, it was usually fairly grotesque. And so, you know, one of the nice things about Scott is that he would, you know, if you had a reasonably plausible case that there was something that needed looking into, you'd say, yeah, go off and look into it. So we went off and we did a bunch of touring around of consumer electronics companies in Europe and Asia, and sort of collected a list of things that were problems. And, you know, we thought that there was an interesting opening for the computer industry there. But we didn't really understand how that universe worked sort of in a sort of subatomic level. So, you know, being fundamentally a bunch of engineers and one really sharp BD guy, we just decided to build a prototype system. And as we were building this thing, which was, you know, if you looked at it, it would be a handheld remote to control things around you. It was you can kind of think of it as an iPad 20 years before the iPad. And oddly enough, some of the hardware folks who built that thing ended up working on the iPad. But as we were building it and thinking about how that industry built software and how that software was entering people's lives, we kept running into issues in the way that sort of C and C++ did things. And so my part of the project was sort of go off and solve the software development issues. And that, you know, started off as, oh, okay, write a quick and cheesy C++ compiler and that sort of does C++ with some things fixed. And that then kind of mushroomed and grew and it eventually became Java. But it wasn't like I woke up one morning and said, oh, I want to do a programming language. It was in the context of this project that had a set of problems to solve.
Did you also have a real-time operating system, or how did that work?
No, we weren't using a real-time operating system. We were actually just using Solaris.
Really?
Wow. Yeah, I mean, one of the unknown secrets of Solaris is that it's actually an excruciatingly good real-time operating system.
Interesting. And the kernel's small enough to get in these constrained environments and...
Yeah, I mean, once you know, throw away all the stuff that you don't need to run a big enterprise server, you know, the kernel inside Solaris is really pretty clean.
Wow.
And, you know, the way that it manages clocks and scheduling, you know, it inherently has to be a real-time operating system in its heart because it's got all of these, you know, strange devices that it's talking to, and it has to be able to schedule quite accurately. You know, so it's pretty much all there.
Interesting. When did the idea of a JVM, an intermediate layer, come in?
That was actually when I was a grad student. Early on, so there used to be this computer company in Pittsburgh called Three Rivers Computers, and they made a workstation like thing called the Perk, P-E-R-Q, and the company was a bunch of electrical engineers who didn't know much about software. And so they decided that instead of like investing in software, what they would do is just grab stuff that they could use for free. So they decided that they would build things around the UCSD Pascal compiler and its P-code engine. So they built a machine that would execute in hardware the Pascal P codes,
the bytecode interpreter.
Yeah, and they did it in hardware.
Wow,
and that worked sort of. I mean, they were nice machines. They never really got traction. The Carnegie Mellon Computer Science Department bought a boatload of them. They never really got hugely useful. But
Perk, by the way, as I'm told, stood for Pascal engine that runs quicker.
I did not know that.
It kind of makes sense.
Yeah. But anyway, at one point, the VAC 780s started rolling in.
Yeah.
And I had two thesis advisors, and one of them was this guy named Raj Reddy, who is quite a character. But at one point, he asked me to if I could figure out how to get the software that they had on the Perk to run on the VAC 780. And I think what he had sort of in mind was that I would write a Pascal compiler. But he didn't actually tell me to do that. He just said, get the software to run. And sort of being lazy, I wanted to do it sort of the easiest way I could find. And so I tried writing a translator from the P code that the UCSD compilers spat out. Into VAX 11780 machine code. And that worked shockingly better than I had expected. I was actually getting better code quality than the C compiler.
Wow.
And there were some things about the P code that made it a little awkward. But it worked really well. I sort of realized that, you know, I could generate code for kind of anything. It didn't have to be a VAX.
All you had to do is write a virtual machine that would interpret that bytecode,
yeah,
and there was a
lot of discussion in the sort of computer, in the sort of the compiler universe about, you know, what was usually called at those days an architecture neutral distribution format. And I thought, well, gee, this is a really, because what everybody was doing was doing these strange serialized forms of parse trees. And this was in fact an instruction set, but if you stood back from the instruction set, it was really a Polish encoded version of a parse tree. But it was a way that had a technique for doing it that had a very clean definition. And I thought that there was probably like a PhD thesis to be had in there. And my thesis committee basically said, no, it can't be a PhD thesis unless there's like theorems and math. So I sort of like gave up on that. But then when we were doing this project at Sun years later, one of the problems that the folks in the consumer electronics industry had was that, you know, every time they built a new device, they had to write all their code
right.
from ground zero. And they wanted to view CPUs as just sort of interchangeable units, right? That they could buy from this supplier, they could buy from that supplier. And software doesn't really work that way in the sort of standard case, right? You compile your software for a particular instruction set, and then you're wedded to that. And then what that means is that if you've built a VCR and you've written the software for it, if you decide to switch suppliers, you're screwed. You're really stuck with that one supplier kind of forever. And the consumer electronics companies hated that.
Oh, yeah.
So they wanted some way that they could switch processor chips. And even it wasn't even just, you know, big switches like from one instruction set to another, but from one version of an instruction set to another, because by then the sort of pain of versioning was already on them. And, you know, as we were doing this tour of, you know, Asia and Europe and talking to all these consumer electronics companies, that was one of the themes of pain for them. And then I sort of thought, you know, I kind of did this almost PhD thesis project that works shockingly well. And I could solve that problem for them. And it would actually work pretty well. That was kind of like, you know, one of the starting points.
It's kind of counterintuitive because it seems like you're adding another layer. You're adding interpretation. I understand the value of writing once and then having it run everywhere. You only have to create a virtual machine for individual devices. How is it that it's efficient?
Well, so one of the things that's really important is the way that the virtual machine does this just-in-time compiling.
JIT.
The JIT. So that there are a bunch of things that come out of having a just-in-time compiler. You know, one of them is you actually know the machine that's running on. Now, for lots of folks, you know, that write C code, they say, well, I'm running on an x86. You know, the x86 architecture comes in, you know, 100 flavors. And, you know, the optimal way of, you know, writing a matrix multiplier or a copy loop on one flavor of x86 is different from another flavor of x86.
But doesn't the compiler, the C compiler,
well, the
C, handle most, that and optimize for the platform?
C compilers have like 10,000 command line options.
A lot of switches, yeah.
A lot of switches. I mean, if you look at the command line options of any C compiler, oh, yeah. It's like a long, long list, right?
Yeah, right.
So, you know, if you know the exact model of like Intel CPU chip that you're targeting, you can put the right set of command line arguments in there and you'll get something that's optimized for that.
Right.
But, you know, when you look at a data center, they didn't buy all their CPU chips at the same time.
Right.
You know, so you end up with, you know, a data center that's, you know, you're trying to do some large scale cloud computation and you take this thing and you roll it out over all the processors in a data center, and they're all, you know, slightly different chips. So the JIT compiler can compile things for exactly the machine that it lands on. So with like a lot of the like large scale data center stuff, if you looked at the code that was executing on one machine versus another, they will be slightly different. And because it, you know, because it looks at, you know, exactly that machine. You know, but there's also the fact that, you know, when you're writing an optimizer for a C compiler, you can optimize the routine in front of you. And it's very difficult to do optimizations that span boundaries between functions. And in particular, if the functions are, you know, loaded into, you are parts of different libraries, It's very difficult to do sort of cross-library optimizations. Whereas once you're in a JIT compiler, it can reach across library boundaries and do crazy amounts of inlining. And it's really the sort of large-scale inlining where the biggest gains happen because, you know, you've written your piece of code that's calling some crypto library. And, you know, if you then look at the code that's actually running, there's no call to the crypto library, right? It's taken the whole, all the pieces of the crypto library and inlined it. And if you're calling some routine and you give it a constant as one parameter, you know, the constant collapsing will happen at runtime.
Right.
And the compiler is able to do all kinds of speculative optimizations.
That's it. That's really interesting. So you're not loading all these libraries and linking them in and all this stuff. You've got the code right there, and it just runs. And that makes sense, especially in a big system. That makes sense. You're going to get a real improvement in performance.
Yeah. So if you look at like benchmarks that are just, you know, single isolated tight loops.
Yeah.
C compilers tend to win,
right?
Although the Java JIT tends to do pretty well too. But as soon as you start looking at benchmarks that span large pieces of code that have a lot of interlinks between libraries,
that makes sense.
The JIT compiler just walks away with it.
Makes a lot of sense. And of course, Java, was it an instant success? Or did it, I remember very well in 94 or 95, Kim Pelees coming and showing us this new thing that everybody was going to move to. And by the way, it is a huge success. It's right now the number one most used language in the world, I think. But was it an instant?
It's astonishing that
it's amazing. And partly because it's not just people using Java. The JVM is being used by, and I know you worked for a Scala company for a while. It's been Clojure
I've been on an advisory board.
So many other languages on top of it. The JVM is a brilliant abstraction that is powering probably a significant portion of the software everybody watching is using, including, of course, and we'll get to this in a moment, your Android device. Not without some problems along the way. But was it an interesting success out of the box? I mean, did people jump on it?
It was really different. My wife sort of beat me into writing this white paper that was the sort of series of stories of how it solved different problems, and lots of people sort of grabbed onto it and went, "Hey, this is really, really cool." And I was completely blown away, when there was a point where, when you have when you work for a company, you often have to write out your annual goals. And as we were coming up to sort of, we had sort of decided that this should go from being a research project to something that we would distribute. My manager asked me to write something in my goals for, what would count as success. And I think my success goal was if 1,000 people downloaded it and tried it out, I'd consider that success. my manager at the time, he thought I was being pretty edgy. He thought that would be kind of difficult to achieve. And I rather grotesquely overachieved on that one.
Oracle today says there's 6.5 million Java programmers in the world. I bet you that number's low. And every time I install Java now, it says something like, did you know there are 1 billion devices running Java?
Well, I mean, part of that math is sort of strange because Java is at the core of most of the smart card specs. So, you know, all, you know, their Java virtual machines, you know, inside smart cards.
No kidding, really?
And inside SIM cards and cell phones.
You're kidding. There's an actual JVM inside this, in that little dumb chip?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, and they're like you know, lots of ID cards.
That's amazing.
Lots of the more advanced ID cards have JVMs in them.
That's a proof of concept. How did your wife know that you should do that? Is she a computer scientist?
No, but she, you know, so my wife's a very sharp lady. You know, one of these sort of Wharton MBA types. And you know, I'd be like really excited about what I was doing, and you know, being a nerd, I'd always, you know, express my excitement in sort of nerd speak. And she was always like, come on, you know, when you're explaining something, it makes no sense to like dive into nerd speak. It's like, for me, a non-nerd, what problems does this solve?
That's a good point. Yeah.
Right. And, yeah. And that's been a sort of a mantra for me, you know, ever since, that, you know, if you've got something exciting, you have to, and you're trying to explain it to somebody, you have to explain it in terms that make sense to the listener, not the speaker.
Right.
You know, so like there was this list of like sort of a dozen cool things, and so like the architecture neutral aspect of the bytecodes, you know, the fact that meant that, for instance, a hardware manufacturer could swap chips somewhat painlessly.
Yeah.
You know, that's not sort of exciting for a nerd, but it sure is exciting for a purchasing manager.
Sure.
You know, so you have to, you know, explain it in a way that makes sense to your audience. And my wife spent a lot of time twisting my arm on that.
Nerds need somebody to help explain what's going on to real people.
Yep. Yep.
We're talking to James Gosling, the father of Java, officer of the Order of Canada. Congratulations. He's also, well, obviously I don't need to tell you, he's quite esteemed fellow of the ACM, the Neumann, von Neumann medal winner, and a great guy. And also a roboticist. We're going to talk about his, liquid robotics in a little bit. But I also want to talk a little bit about, because if Java were a rock band, and this were the show, you know, about the story of the rock, there's an arc, you know, and Java succeeds, and then the trouble starts, and boy, there's Java has been fought over by some of the biggest tech companies in the world, including Microsoft, Google, Oracle, its current owner, and I'm very curious in your take on all of that. We won't spend a long time belaboring that, but I'm just, particularly about the Oracle versus Google suit, I'm really curious what your thoughts are on that. But we're going to take a break right now, and we'll get back to more with James Gosling in just a little bit. Our show today brought to you by magazines, the best magazines in the world, and not just the Netflix of magazines, a company that makes those magazines, puts all those magazines on your tablet or your phone so you can read them whenever you want, even if you don't have an internet connection, for a flat monthly rate that is lower than just buying a couple of copies of that magazine. Now, you know, there's magazines with, I would say there's probably two dozen magazines every month with an article I want to read, whether it's Vanity Fair or The New Yorker or Esquire or Rolling Stone, Wired Magazine. Okay, every once in a while I want to see what's going on in People. But if I had subscriptions to all of those, it would add up to hundreds of dollars. If I bought copies of those on the newsstand, even more, and not to mention the clutter. This is decluttering your coffee table, because all of those magazines are more available to you right there on your tablet. We're all these days binge watching TV. Well, now you can binge read magazines, the best magazines ever. You know, I have to say, texture is really saving this medium. It's a great medium. Articles that are thoughtful. Articles that are engaging, pictures too. You get National Geographic and Architectural Digest. I just love browsing through those, getting ideas. Look at all the magazines. Go to texture.com/triangulation. You can try it free right now. It works, as I said, on your phone or your tablet. It is the full magazine, by the way. Every page that you would get on the newsstand, plus back issues. So you're getting it all, even bonus articles, bonus features like video that you couldn't put in a magazine. Consumer Reports, Cosmopolitan. Cycle World. Dwell is another one. I love to just look at the ideas and dwell. It's always a lot of fun. So you also get easy-to-find articles about topics you care about. They're curated collections. Will point you in the right direction. So if you've never read Decor magazine, but there's an article in there you'd be interested in, you can find those very quickly. They've really reimagined the magazine reading experience. And you're going to love it. Try it for free right now. Gain insider access to all the content from the world's most in-demand publications. Star your favorite magazines. They'll instantly be added to your personal library, downloaded before your next trip. You can even share your subscription with your family. Okay, now I'm talking, huh? Lisa shares hers with me. That's how I know that. Texture.com/triangulation. Sign up and get that free trial. It is a great idea. Kind of Netflix for magazines. You may remember the name Next Issue. We did ads for them for a long time. They've rebranded, so this is Next Issue. But it's called Texture now. Texture, and I like that name, actually, texture.com. Because it's every issue. Triangulation. My grandma used to have in her basement a wall of National Geographics. Now it's all on an iPad. You can have hundreds of years or whatever, how many issues they have on your iPad. Texture.com/triangulation. Our guest is, is there a title if you are an officer of the Order of Canada? Do I call you Sir James Gosling?
I think if the Order of Canada were a British thing,
yeah, you'd be something.
But Canadians don't do that.
They're too
so
nice.
That's not a part of the thing.
Must have felt good though. You stayed at Sun a long time. In fact, you stayed right through the acquisition by Oracle.
Right.
Moved on to it for a few months. Were at Google, I think I remember.
Yeah, I was there for about 6 months.
Yeah. Which must have been an interesting thing, given the fact that almost immediately Oracle and Google. Well, you write that during the integration meetings between Sun and Oracle, we were being grilled about the patent situation between Sun and Google. We could see the Oracle lawyers' eyes sparkle. Oracle, I'm sure, believed that they could recoup some of the cost of acquiring Sun in this lawsuit. So what was the issue about? Google says it was clean room. We didn't copy Java code. We just copied the APIs. It seems to be about APIs.
It's hard to know what the truth really was, right? I mean, before all of that, Google had been in intense negotiation with us to get a license for Java and use our VM
in Android.
Yeah, in Android. We sort of had this problem with they just wanted it for free. We had this problem that we had a lot of engineers working on it. And, while we were giving away Java for like enterprise use, we were charging like phone companies and that for embedded stuff in handsets. We kind of had to have a way to pay the salaries of all these engineers, right? And Google wanted us to have all these engineers working for them for free. And, we wanted something, right? They had a very clear revenue model based on advertising, and they were completely unwilling to do anything to help us, pay the bills. And, you know, we had offered them a price that, you know, in retrospect was like way small. They spent way more on lawyers.
Yeah.
Than they ever would have if they had just, you know, paid the license we offered them. And, you know, Google is a bunch of people, and, you know, individuals all have different ways of operating. And, you know, the you know, we got a fairly... I keep wanting to like devolve into a rant of profanity here, but I'll not do that.
Okay. Although if you wanted to, it'd be good for ratings.
Yeah, I suppose.
I'm not going to stop you.
but we sort of parted company. You know, feeling that they had been fairly abusive, and
they didn't though. They wrote their own. Basically, that Dalvik, the JV,
yeah,
is their own.
They came out with that later.
Ah,
and yeah, they wrote the Dalvik VM, exactly where the source code for some of their libraries and that came from. Who knows? I mean, in the discovery process, a lot of the code looked really similar.
Oh, interesting.
And then their code base changed over time, and since I wasn't actually involved in the lawsuit, you know, I never got to see the insides of anything.
Right.
But you know, there are, you know, from the Sun side, we weren't very happy.
You used the word Google slimed us.
Yeah, that was kind of how that was kind of the consensus opinion. But, you know, Scott is not someone who likes to get involved in lawsuits. And so even though, you know, we were fairly unhappy with them.
Before Oracle's acquisition.
Yeah, long before Oracle's acquisition.
Yeah.
We decided to just let it slide because it would just turn into a...
Well, what it did turn into. An endless...
Yeah, it was just going to get... It just didn't feel that, you know, whatever right and wrong was, there was no good path.
Yeah.
And so they just sort of did their thing, and you know, then Oracle takes over, and you know, Oracle is Oracle, right? They're an organization that's driven by arithmetic. And you know, it's the balance sheet at the end of the month, and you know, here's this, you know, unharvested potential source of cash, and then, you know, they start coming up with, you know, legal arguments to try to make things stick, and you know, what's good, right, what's bad, what's right, what's wrong, boy, oh boy, that's just like too sticky for me.
Yeah,
you know, when it comes to this case, I kind of feel like. You know, there are no good guys in this one.
Yeah, I mean, I would hate to see, you know, a law or a ruling that APIs are copyrightable, because that would have a chilling effect across the whole.
Yeah, that would be bad. But it kind of feels like, you know, the lawyers and laws and legal teams are... They do what they can.
That's where they decided to pursue it. But it sounds like there's actually something a lot more actionable, but they decided they can't pursue that. By the way, just in case you're curious, because, you know, when you mention this Oracle-Google lawsuit, then the first thing people say is, oh, wait a minute, isn't that over? Didn't the jury say that Google didn't infringe? Yeah, but then Federal Circuit of Court of Appeals reversed the decision. And the second trial, new trial, is scheduled for May next month, and Oracle is now seeking $9.3 billion in damages. So we have not seen the end of this sad. It's not the end of Java by any means. That's the good news. Java is going strong. You used to do at Java 1, you used to do a toy talk at the end of Java 1. What? Tell me about some of the toys these days you're seeing, that things that people are doing with Java that you like.
It's kind of all over the map.
It's everywhere, I mean, isn't it? Yeah.
You know, it's really entertaining to see what people do. You know, like in the Raspberry Pi world, it's kind of like all over the place.
Minecraft is written in Java. Let's not forget.
Yeah, which I find really, really ironic that, you know, Minecraft had become one of the biggest teaching platforms for Java programming.
That's right.
You know, all these young kids learning how to do Minecraft mods, and all this like course material about, you know, how to make your own, you know, sword with certain magical powers.
Yeah.
You know, how to build, you know, a ship that can fly and harvest electricity and turn it into lightning bolts to smite your enemies. You know, as a vehicle to learn. And then Microsoft buys it.
Isn't that ironic? Well, you worked for Microsoft briefly. Microsoft isn't, I don't even want to go down this road, but Microsoft also said, oh, you know, we don't want to pay for Java. And, Apple, too. The whole thing is a mess.
Yeah. The actually, you know, with Microsoft and Apple, money was never an issue. You know, the control was always an issue.
Right.
Right.
You want a platform that is universal. You don't want Microsoft Java. You don't want Apple Java.
So a lot depends on your point of view, right? If you're a software developer, you know, the kind of universe you'd like to live in is one where, you know, you can write some application and you can sell it to people who buy Apple computers, or you can sell it to people who buy, you know, Windows PCs. And but if you're if you're a computer manufacturer, if you're an OS vendor, mm-hmm. What most people want is what at Sun we used to call the Roach Motel model.
Yeah.
Namely, you know, the roaches check in, but they never check out.
Right.
Do you remember those TV ads?
I do. I know exactly what you're talking about the minute you said it.
Right. And so... You know, when Microsoft originally signed on as a Java licensee, the all the people involved in that were wonderful. They did great work. That lasted about a year, and there was this like grand email from Bill Gates that came up in one of the antitrust cases that had this line, you know, Microsoft does not work that way.
Right.
You know, and so it was all about control.
You know,
and a similar sort of thing happened with Apple. I mean, in the early days, when Steve Jobs had come back to Apple and Apple was trying to make a comeback and they were desperate for developers, they were very enthusiastic about Java, and they worked really well. And Steve Jobs actually gave a talk at Java one year, and you know, I spent the whole time before that, you know, with him. And that was great. They were really enthusiastic, but you know, Apple has always been about control. They want to control their own destiny. And, you know, I'm a big fan of Apple products. I use them all the time. I'm, you know, the laptop in front of me is a Mac, you know, but they, you know, really put the freak in control freak.
Yeah.
And that has its good things and it has its bad things. And
well, to their credit, you know, it is running a form of BSD, so.
Yeah, although these days, not something that a real BSD person would call BSD.
Why don't you run OpenBSD or FreeBSD or some variant of the...
You mean on
why don't you use it? You're a Unix guy or Linux.
Yeah, I mean, you know, in the Linux part of my life, I normally use Ubuntu. Mm-hmm. But that's more because most of the packages I want to use are more likely to be extensively tested and, right. and QA'd. Right. You know, in my heart of hearts, I would much rather use BSD. You know, these days, if only because they've got ZFS integrated mm-hmm. into the core of it, mm-hmm. and ZFS is unbelievable. And
another great Sun invention. Yeah.
Well, you know, we spent a lot of time on it, and yeah. and I'm really heartbroken how Oracle has completely, I guess, screwed the pooch is the phrase I was trying to avoid, but.
There was briefly, Apple was briefly said to be considering ZFS instead of HFS for its file system. They abandoned that at some point, which yeah. is a great shame.
Yeah, it's not entirely clear what went on there. I mean, they were very close to releasing, and our CEO at the time, Jonathan, sort of pre-announced it. And exactly what happened, I'm not sure, yeah. but, you know, the general rumor mill at the time was that, you know, Steve Jobs went, no, we control the message. Ugh.
Well, it is possible to use ZFS in Linux, but you have to recompile the kernel to rebuild the kernel from source to do it. I've been tempted.
Yeah, it's gotten easier than that. You can actually dynamically link.
Oh, that's good. That's good.
In BSD, it's completely trivial.
Right. I'm very tempted. I keep wanting to install OpenBSD on one of my systems, or maybe just build a BSD system. Be kind of nice to have.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about the Wave Glider. Your current job is writing software for robotic submarines.
It's not a submarine.
Oh, what is it?
It's actually on the surface.
Oh, I apologize. I've been calling it. It's yeah. an ocean robot.
Yeah. Yeah, so if you look me up on Vimeo, you'll find a video that sort of shows how it works. But a wave glider is essentially a, you know, if you took a surfboard and a kayak and you kind of melded them together. And then there's this
oh, that's cool. Umbilical,
and then there's this umbilical cable that goes down about 20 feet. And there's this, oh, you've got it there.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there you see the wave glider. And then down below it, there's this cable that links to this wing rack. And it's got these wings that go up and down. There's springs that dampen their motion. And so the wave glider is up in the ocean, and up on the surface where it bounces up and down. The wing rack is down where the ocean is calm. And so it uses that differential to generate forward thrust, kind of the way that a whale's tail works. So the float is up in the waves, and we often tow instruments.
How interesting. And you have, and of course, the other reason to have something up in the waves is for solar power.
Yeah, so we get all of our electricity from the solar panels on top, and we get forward thrust from the wing rack.
Wow.
And both of those are totally infinite. The wave gliders can stay out in the ocean for months and months and months. And what's not really clear is that the device is incredibly robust. You know, our design point is you know, a Category 5 hurricane. We're pretty much wow. the only ocean-going thing that will happily go into hurricanes. And so the device is really a platform for instruments, and you can bolt onto it all kinds of things. And the tow bodies, in that animation, there was a thing towed behind. Those often will contain things like acoustics. So one of the things that we do is marine protected area enforcement. So we can listen for poachers. And that's a pretty cool thing to do. But also, you know, a lot of scientists will do things like measuring water chemistry, measuring ocean acidification. you can put like salinity sensors on them and, you know, measure everything from like, you know, the melting of the Greenland ice caps to, you know, what's going on with ice in the Arctic. You know, we do Arctic missions, fairly frequently.
There's several hundred of these, out there.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, they work as weather stations. They can do pollution monitoring around oil rigs.
They're fully autonomous.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. So the software on board is a big bag of Java code. And there's a fairly sophisticated AI system in it that you give it a mission and it goes and does the mission. You can modify the mission on the fly over the satellite link. And you know, some of the sensor data comes back over the satellite link. But, you know, the satellite link is slow and erratic. So the vessel has to be able to go for a long time without any communication with the shore. And, you know, so if they're doing a long transit, you know, so like, we've got one right now just coming back from the Pitcairn Islands and, where we'd been doing fisheries enforcement with it. And it's, I don't know if you look on a map where Pitcairn Island is, but it's way in the South Pacific.
Isn't that where the Bounty mutineers got stuck?
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's
remote.
It's kind of an entertaining place, but
I bet.
You know, rather than, you know, fly down there to install an instrument and deinstall it, we just have them swim home when it, you know, it
that's so cool.
You know, that one needs to have its hull scrubbed, so we're just having it swim home to Hawaii.
That is so cool.
You know, and it takes a few weeks, but you know, you just say come home and it comes home.
How do you avoid getting clobbered by other shipping traffic?
Well, that's where the AI part comes in. One of the more entertaining pieces of code I had to write a couple of years ago was, oh, you've actually got one of my demo simulations.
I kind of knew the answer before I asked the question.
Yeah.
So here's the Java code. And
yeah, so it's actually pretty good at going, you give it a mission plan, and the mission plan can have obstacles, and then sort of dynamic obstacles can sort of flow into that, and you know, you can see where the wave glider has sort of deviated off to
right.
the side.
Right.
You know, it avoids the ships and it works its way around the obstacles and, you know, tries to stay on the target line. That it was told to go from, you know, between those dots that are kind of cyan colored, and it had those obstacles in the way.
And so just swim around them.
Yeah, it swims around them quite nicely, and you know, it's able to sort out, like, if there are multiple ships that it has to dodge at the same time, it does all that. And, you know, writing that kind of code in C is really, really hard. You end up with data structures that are really hard to reclaim, inevitable memory leaks.
Yeah.
But it's pretty straightforward to do that kind of stuff in Java. You know, so all of those sort of like control algorithms get much, much, much simpler when you've got a language like Java to work with. So yeah, it's been pretty entertaining. And you know, it's been hard to get people to believe that it can actually do collision avoidance well. Some of the incidents have been, you know, pretty comical.
Boats trying to avoid it as it's avoiding the boat and. Yeah.
Oh, we have
after
this,
you, Alphonse.
You know, really early on, you know, the first time we launched a wave glider with the collision avoidance stuff in it, our engineering crews, you know, a few days later, and I went to go pick up the wave glider because we needed to fuss with it, and I ended up with this phone call with a, you know, screaming boat crew because they couldn't pick it up.
Oh, because it was avoiding them.
It was avoiding them. They spent an hour trying to pick this thing up. And I said, just turn collision avoidance off.
You can't pick
And we've had a couple of customers do the same thing.
That's hysterical.
Our operation center has gotten these like irate phone calls from customers, and it's like, damn it, don't you like it when software actually works?
It's nice.
Yeah.
Well, there's a lot of software running James Gosling's code. We owe a lot to the father of Java, and not just Java programs. As I mentioned, there are a great many other programs sitting on top of the JVM, including Python and Jython, I guess it's called, and there's a JRuby, and I love Clojure. Clojure sits on top of the JVM.
Scala.
And Scala, of course, yeah. It's really proven to be an incredibly robust system. And, of course, anybody who has an Android phone, darn it, you can thank this guy. If you want to send him a check, I'm sure he'll accept donations. Don't send him to Oracle, though. They don't deserve it. Thank you, James Gosling. I'm going to call you Sir James Gosling. A real pleasure to talk to you. And
thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, lots of fun. And thank you so much for creating Java and changing the world.
Well, it's been fun.
Yeah.
I'm enjoying being a user these days.
So. Isn't that nice? You get to use your own creation.
Yeah, yeah.
What kind of computer is on those wave riders?
Let's see. Most of the ones that are swimming right now have a TI OMAP 6000 series ARM processor on them. And, you know, we've been doing a lot of stuff with the NVIDIA TK1s and TX1s that we put in, like, payload boxes. And we're starting the work of converting over to using, like, the TX1 everywhere, which, you know, at, like, a teraflop, it just makes my head explode. It's so wonderful. I mean, the things I'm going to be able to do once that's real.
You're seeing the strength, though, of this whole idea of a virtual machine is it doesn't matter. You just swap out the processor. You want to work with great. ARM? No big deal, you know?
Yeah, we built up a prototype machine with a TX1 in it, and, you know, it has, like, more cores and a different instruction set and all the rest of that, and it just freaking worked.
That's neat. Do you write the JVMs? Have you written JVMs, or is that how hard is that to do? Is that a...
Well, I wrote the very first one.
Mm-hmm.
The reference. If you try to do a basic JVM that just does, like, interpreting the bytecodes, that's really easy. Doesn't take much work at all to write that. You can actually get something moderately workable in a weekend.
Wow.
If you try to get, like, really high performance with a really good garbage collector, that's many man years, you know. I mean, people call me the inventor of Java or the father of Java, but in fact, I've done such a small fraction of the work involved in making Java be what it is. I mean, the engineering team that works on the JDK is terrific.
Yeah.
Way smarter than I am. Yeah.
Well, we thank you, and I thank you for your time today. It's been great talking to you.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks, James. We talked to some of the best minds. I tell you, it's so much fun doing this show, and I hope you see and watch every one of them. And, of course, you don't have to watch them live, although it's always fun. We start at 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern. That's 1800 UTC on every Monday, and great guests aplenty. But if you can't watch live, you can always get on-demand audio and video of everything we do at twit.tv. In the case of this show, it's twit.tv/TRI. That's where it starts, but of course iTunes and any podcast application you could subscribe, get it every single week. You'll find it on, we have Twit apps. We didn't write any of them, written for every platform. I'm sure there's one in Java on the Windows platform, on the iOS, the Android. Well, there is Android on Apple TV. There's 5 Twit apps. People just seem to like to write Twit apps, Roku. So find one, get the show, subscribe, and that way you won't miss an episode. Thanks for being here. We'll see you next time on Triangulation. Bye-bye.